The poor, the Spirit of Christ, never as powerful as when unleashed among the poor, found an open door to Europe in the 1100s. Poor people everywhere, in crowded urban misery, on feudal estates, serving corrupt churchmen that oppressed and abused them, turned in amazing numbers to the gospel. They could understand the gospel of Christ, especially in southern France. After Pierre's conversion, a great number of Albigensian believers of the region, many of whose own leaders had become lukewarm and careless, identified with him at once. But Roman Catholic authorities became furious. What might the church come to, they stormed, if unlearned men throw the scriptures before the masses in their own language? Why, any farmer or housewife will do with them what they want. Called the Popers de Lugdunum, the poor of Lyon, Pierre de Valdes and his friends went out to tell the world what they had found. An English theologian, Walter Mapp, who came to know them on a trip to Italy, wrote in 1179, "These people have no fixed residence. They go around two by two, barefooted and dressed in woolen tunics. They own nothing. Whatever they use, they hold in common, after the manner of the apostles. Naked, they follow a naked Christ. As of now, their impact is still negligible, because their following is small. But if we were to leave them alone, I do not doubt they might yet be the ruin of us all." An inquisitor, sent by Roman Catholic authorities to suppress the poor, remarked, "Not one of them, old or young, man or woman, by day or by night, ever stops learning and teaching others." He also quoted one of the poor brought before him, "In our homes, women teach as well as men, and one who has been a student for a week teaches another." Unlike Gioacchino's movement in the mountains of southern Italy, the poor of Lyon lived in the city. Giorgio Turn, a Waldensian historian, writes, "They wished to be part and parcel of the life of the city. They were not hermits seeking the solitude of the desert. Their calling was to be present in churches, public squares, and homes where their message could be heard. They were and wished to remain citizens of Lyon, one of the great cities of Western Europe, on the route of the Crusades where St. Bernard had preached, where a great cathedral, St. John's, was under construction. This urban environment was their world. To it belonged the promise of transformation. Here they chose to live out their discipleship." The poor in Lombardy across the Cotian Alps, in the city of Milan and plains of Lombardy around it, messengers from Lyon found prepared soil. The Paterini still met in Milan. Among them, as among others who prayed to Christ, their teaching took root and grew into a healthy plant of its own. In fact, it grew into an expression of Christian living unlike anything the poor had known. Giorgio Turn writes, "The witness given by the poor in Lombardy very soon became independent of the Lyonese pattern. The Lombards tended to see the apostolic calling as one rooted in community, societas, and not necessarily implying itinerant preaching. They felt that to travel across the countryside preaching was one way of living, like the apostles, but not the only way. Another was to share commitment unselfishly with one's sisters and brothers in the faith. In other words, the Lombard poor reflected the emphasis recorded in Acts 1-4 on Christian community, while their counterparts from Lyon honed in on the missionary message of the Jesus they found in Matthew 10. It was not by accident that the main point of discussion between the two groups was on the way they should regard work. According to the Lyonese, labor was an impediment to witness and a temptation to accumulate wealth. For the Lombards, one's daily task was an instrument of service, the opportunity for concrete witness. The poor of Lyon tended to be pilgrim preachers, bards of conversion not greatly dissimilar from the wandering minstrels of the time. The central figure for the Lombard poor, on the other hand, was the artisan, the wool carder in a textile shop, the laborer, the worker. A deep sense of social solidarity was found among the Lombard poor. They possessed considerable organizing ability. Their life and witness were well structured, and not, as in Lyon, somewhat euphoric and spontaneous. Domingo. Whether settled in Christian communities or out on the road preaching, all the poor drew the clouds of Europe's wrath down on them sooner or later. 100 years before Pierre Valdez's time, European authorities already burned non-Roman Catholics at the stake, 14 at Orleans in 1022, more at Aachen in Germany, and after 1100 a great many Albigenses in Arles, Toulouse, and Narbonne, cities of the Languedoc region and neighboring Gascony. But the storm did not break loose until a young man from Spain, Domingo de Guzman, appeared. After his mother died, Domingo's wealthy father sent to him to study in southern France. There, at his uncle's home, he came to know the Albigenses, still strong in numbers even though fallen somewhat from their early principles. He observed the Waldensian movement rapidly growing out of it. He learned of the Paterini, the Tisserands, and poor Christians like them that captured the imagination of Europe and felt discouraged. "What shall become of our mother, the Catholic Church," he wondered, "if all this goes to seed?" Sitting outside the Languedoc village of Fanjeaux on the summer evening of July 22, 1206, the feast of St. Mary Magdalene, the solution suddenly came to Domingo de Guzman. The poor, it dawned on him, must be conquered by the poor. The heretical poor multiplied so rapidly, Domingo reasoned, because they saw nothing but wealth and corruption in the state church. But if Roman Catholics, even just a few, would turn to living in simplicity, poverty, and chastity like Christ, what would they have to say? With an option for real Christian living within the Catholic Church, wouldn't many seekers prefer it and not go astray? Looking out across the wide and fertile plains of Languedoc, where the steeples of Carcassonne, Castelnuodary, and Montreal stood in the glow of sunset among ripening grain, Domingo sat lost in thought. Then, scarcely believing his eyes, he jumped to his feet. What was it? The heavens opened, not once, but three times, for a burning orb to appear and descend on an abandoned church at Pruy, a village between Fanjeaux and Montreal in the very heart of the Albigensian region. Domingo could wait no longer. He took the vision as a sign of God's approval on his idea and asked the Bishop of Toulouse for the abandoned church. With the friends who joined him there, all devout Catholics, he shed his wealth and comfort to begin living like Pierre Valdez. He put on rough clothes and sandals, and walked with his friends from village to village preaching the message of Christ, and more. Unlike the heretics, Domingo and his friends, who became the Dominican order, swore a solemn oath to remain true to the Holy Roman Church. They taught people to follow Christ where it suited, but that no one could hope for salvation outside of going to Mass, confessing to a priest, and belonging to the state church. By the time they had worked 10 years in southern France and abroad, the Pope recognized the Dominicans as Christ's invincible athletes, and a wealthy nobleman, Simon de Montfort, gave them the feudal estate of Cassinoil for their headquarters. Blood and smoke. Less than a year after Domingo's vision, the Pope, who supported him, sent a letter to all prelates, counts, and barons, and to all people in the Kingdom of France, calling on them to avenge the insult of the Crucified One by cleansing the land of heresy. To whoever would take part in this crusade, he promised forgiveness of sins and eternal life. Domingo de Guzman found himself surrounded with loyal supporters at once. The Bishop of Toulouse, monk, songwriter, and professional clown, took it upon himself to make the crusade even more attractive. Not only will your sins be forgiven, he promised the people. If you lose your lives in this campaign, you will die as martyrs and bypass purgatory. From all over France and other European countries, the crusaders came. Responding to pleas of the Abbot of Citeaux, the Duke of Narbonne, and the Archbishops of Reims, Sens, and Rouen, counts and noblemen came with around 20,000 knights on horseback and 200,000 foot soldiers, followed by innumerable priests and common people. Religious fanatics, highwaymen, thieves, or simple peasants looking for adventure all found their way to southern France. The Pope put their families and the homes they left behind under special protection. He absolved them from paying debts for the time being, and with the Bishop of Toulouse prayed blessings on their swords and spears. The deluge of fire and blood began in Languedoc in 1208, after the bishop, in full pontifical attire, had blessed the crusaders and told them, "Up to now you have fought for the earthly, now you may fight for the eternal." They fell on Chassenoul, a town with a large percentage of Albigensian residents, and Béziers. At Béziers, the crusaders told city authorities to give up the heretics among them so the rest might be spared. But the authorities, even though Catholic, could not do so in good conscience, and perhaps 20,000 died as crusaders put all who escaped to the sword. During the massacre, a deliberate attempt at terrorizing other Languedoc towns, the Abbot of Citeaux encouraged crusaders confused as to who was a heretic or not. "Kill them all. The Lord will know his own." From here, the crusaders swept like a tornado westward, burning 140 Albigenses at Minerve, hanging 80 at Lavor, burning another 400 at that place several months later, and 80 at Castres, between Albi and Carcassonne. Wherever they went on their wild and bloody rampage, they left a trail of destruction behind. Burnt buildings, homeless orphans, and entire villages in ruins. So outrageously did they treat their victims, violating the women and mutilating men, gouging out eyes and slitting noses, that thousands who were not Albigenses resisted crusading troops, and the region erupted in civil war. Feudal lords of the region did what they could to protect the Albigenses, but one after another their castles fell. New crusaders kept pouring in from Germany, Italy, and faraway Slavic lands until Languedoc lay devastated and attention shifted to the poor. In 1221, Conrad, Bishop of Portuas, founded the Military Order of the Faith of Jesus Christ. 3 years later, Frederick II of Hohenstaufen, Holy Roman Emperor, ordered the poor of Lombardy rounded up, burned at the stake, and their property confiscated. This, within a short time, became standard procedure in Roman Catholic lands. Then, in 1231, Pope Gregory IX established the Holy Office of Inquisition. Hounds of heresy in the late 1220s, the Crusaders left southern France and returned home. Of the Albigensian community, they had nothing left to destroy. But what to say by no means the memory? What believers in southern France had treasured for 1,000 years? The joy of living with Christ, untrammeled by state church controls, could not be quickly extinguished. In fact, the crusade against the Albigenses did little else than confirm true seekers in their belief that the Church of Rome was the devil's hoard. For every Albigensian believer that lost his life in southern France, 3 more joined movements of the poor in other parts of Europe, and worried authorities scurried to find new tactics of suppression. Once again, Dominicans took the lead, followed closely by Francis of Assisi's, by now thoroughly Catholicized, and Orthodox Friars Minor. Fratres Predicatores, preaching brothers, fast became Fratres Persecutors, persecuting brothers, as the mendicant orders became Rome's hounds to sniff out the heresies of Europe. In nearly all important cities, Dominicans took charge of the Pope's holy office. Their technique was simple. Dominican inquisitors moved into an area. They proclaimed a period of grace during which heretics could voluntarily recant and receive pardon. Then, after a few weeks, they began to accept denunciations. All those accused, even anonymously, by 2 or more informers, they arrested and tried, often under torture. A solemn oath to speak the truth, requested when Inquisition trials began, more often than not settled the case at once. Neither the Albigenses nor the poor that followed them would swear. Therefore, accused men or women who refused the oath invited Dominican suspicion and torture to extract more evidence. Believers had their toes and fingers pinched. Professional torturers pulled them up with ropes, often upside down, stretched their limbs on racks and wheels, burned them with coals, or poured boiling water down their throats. Uno valsen agols, valbagols. Where kindness fails, sticks will succeed, the inquisitors believed. And when heretics refused to recant, they brought them before church and state officials to hear their sentence in an auto da fe, act of faith. Following excommunication and the Roman Church's official curse, civil authorities led heretics promptly to the site of execution, usually a stake where they burned them alive. All their property fell into the hands of their persecutors that used the money they got from it to build new churches and monasteries, equip more crusades, and make the life of the upper hierarchy ever more luxurious. Under powerful and gifted men, the Holy Office of Inquisition became Rome's long shadow hanging over Europe. But the flower of faith, once blooming in Languedoc, had gone to seed, and no amount of determined effort could exterminate it again. The witness spreads no matter how great the power of Roman Catholic armies and kings, no matter how glorious their churches, their music, or religious pageantry, those who sought rest for their souls kept looking elsewhere for direction. More often than not, they looked to the poor. Unlike wealthy churchmen and conniving monks, the poor led godly lives. Love for Christ drew them out of worldly comforts to set an example of honesty and justice for all. For this reason, it did not take long, after their dispersion from southern France and Lombardy, until new groups of seekers formed around them. From Lyon, the poor fled north through Toul and Metz into the Rhine Valley. So numerous did they become in Toul by 1192 that the city published an edict against them. 19 years later, in 1211, authorities burned 80 in Strasbourg. From Lombardy's Christian communes, scholae like those of Milan, Bergamo, Brescia, Como, and Pavia, messengers found their way north into Switzerland and beyond. So thoroughly did the witness of Lombardian brothers like Ugolo and Algoso penetrate the region that by the mid-1200s one could travel from Florence in Italy to Cologne on the Rhine, lodging in believers' homes every night along the way. Refugees followed the messengers north, and scholae sprang up far more rapidly than inquisitors could keep track of them. Wherever they met, the poor, or Waldenses, as they became known, learned from handwritten copies of the scriptures they passed from place to place. Young people memorized them, and the scriptures became a guide for their life together. As persecution increased, it became impossible to preach on street corners and in public meetings, but the strength of the movement only grew. In the words of one historian, it was a clandestine world throughout, one that made the most of night meetings in stables and back rooms of little shops. Each generation was careful to transmit the faith to the succeeding one, the young sitting at the feet of elders, who in turn had received instruction from their parents. The poor were constrained to keep the faith alive within the walls of their homes, indeed within the recesses of their own hearts. Yet if the streets were closed to them, they still had their gatherings in the kitchen, at their washing places by the streams and in their shops. The Lombard Schola thus lived again in the Waldensian home, a secure place where teaching and mutual strengthening in the faith could be carried on. Not only did brothers and sisters draw closer one to another in adversity, they drew closer to Christ, the living word. An anonymous reporter from Passau on the Danube wrote in the 13th century, "All those men and women from Lyon, young and old, keep learning all the time, by day and by night. Tradesmen work by day and study by night. Newly converted ones, after a few days, are already drawing others into the sect. Believers wrote instructive letters one to another and met when they could for encouragement, but nothing did more for them than personal hunger for truth, studying the scriptures themselves. An illegal act in France after 1229 and in other countries soon afterward, they discovered what to believe and why, making it possible for a Roman Catholic inquisitor to report of a heretic. With wonderful liberty, he told the court that he would not swear oaths. He did not believe in auricular confession, in the infallibility of church councils, the ceremony of the Mass, blind obedience to the church, university degrees and titles, the use of worldly force by church leaders, and worldly rule by Christians. With such clarity, nothing could stop the witness of the poor from exploding through German lands.